you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 198 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyron, your host as usual. And just before we get started here, notice that we're on episode 198. We have two to go, and then we'll be at episode 200. And I really wanted to do something special for episode 200. I have a phenomenal guest coming aboard in a couple of weeks for our 200th episode. He is an entrepreneur of significant note, an attorney, an all-around great guy, and I can't wait to reveal who that is. So this is just a little tease. You're going to want to make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast if you aren't already, and look forward to episode 200, which will be in just a couple of weeks. But today, I am really honored to have my friend Marissa Levin as my guest. I met Marissa initially through the networking group that I've spoke about often on this podcast here in the DC area called Cadre, run by Derek and his wife, Derek Coburn, and his wife, Melanie. And Marissa is a serial entrepreneur. She has created and operated three different businesses, two ongoing at the time, most notably her company called Successful Culture International is just the standard bearer in that space for helping companies and, by example, law firms such as ours on how to develop a positive corporate culture, one that leads to continued growth and development on the part of the firm. She's also a well-received author. She writes a column for Inc. magazine, and more specifically, she wrote a book called Built to Scale, and we'll tell you how you can go about getting that book a little later, about the power of building organizations through the use of advisory boards. So it's really interesting, and of course, she is also the host of her own podcast called The Culture Podcast, and we'll have all the links to all of that in the show notes, but we have a really in-depth discussion about what it means to have a good culture in your law firm, and how does that translate into action, and what does it do to the bottom line and the overall effectiveness of your firm. So this is a really interesting discussion. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did having it with my friend Marissa Levin. Marissa Levin, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil. It is such a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I'm delighted to have you as a guest on our show today. Marissa, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
So I am a 27-year serial entrepreneur. I own three different businesses, and I launched my first business 27 years ago after working for a man who told me that I would never be worth more than $35,000 to his company.
Wow.
Yeah, so as they say, the rest is history. I built my first company to that point. We got that company to around $13 million in revenue. I exited that company, stepped away from it about 8 years ago, launched a second business, built that one, and merged it with another company to take it to another level. And then in between all of that, I launched a third company. So I definitely have been bitten by the entrepreneurial bug, and I love creating great places to work and great organizations.
Sure. Now, you know, the great coda to that story would be, did you turn around and buy that original guy's company out from under him to teach him a lesson?
So, no, I didn't. The two things that I did do, I ended up hiring my former boss from that company to come work for me at Information Experts. And I did send a progress report and a thank you note to the owner of the first company, because truly, if he would have valued me, I probably wouldn't have left.
Yeah. Yeah. So in some ways a blessing in disguise, but
an awful
backhanded way of getting there. So now you've got three businesses that you operate. Let's talk just briefly about what do they do? What is their focus?
Okay, so what I'm operating now, Information Experts, is my first business, and I have not been involved in that in many, many years. When I left that, I then launched a solopreneurship company called Successful Culture LLC, and that was just me. And really, through that company, I work with high-level CEOs to coach them on everything from leadership, mindset, team building, personal and professional growth, and I still have a handful of clients through that company. I then merged our corporate culture skills from that company with my dear friend, Jennifer Brown, who I've known for almost 20 years, and she had a company called People Tactics. And we merged our companies to create Successful Culture International, SCI. And that is a global corporate culture consultancy where we work organizations to help them figure out what's not working in their companies. And companies that come to us always have pain. No one ever comes to us because everything is working well. They come to us because they can't attract and hire, retain and recruit the right people. They have high attrition. They are losing money in the top line and the bottom line, both with profits and revenues. They've got bad morale. And all of those types of things are common in every company. What matters is that leaders get in front of it and get ahead of it and address these types of problems before they really kind of explode into something that's not controllable. So we work with companies to really diagnose what is wrong with their corporate culture and how to help them truly create great places to work where employees thrive and grow and feel safe and feel that they can really reach their own potential. So that's SCI. And then I have another company called Women's CEO Roundtable with another partner, Tina Johnson. And that is really very much of a passion project. It is a formal company, another LLC. And we've created a year-long cohort program of women business owners to help them get to the next levels of growth. And we address mindset, skill set. We give them the resources, the communities, the tools they need to move from where they are now to where they want to be. And for most of the women who come into our group, it's the first time they've ever had a community of like-minded peers that they can, you know, share their problems with. And, mm-hmm. and we facilitate and orchestrate a guided roundtable session so that they also, in addition to learning from subject matter experts that come in to speak, they have a safe place to bring their business challenges and get them addressed in real time.
Well, it's a fascinating collection of tech skills and objectives and goals for a variety of companies here that you have. And I will tell you that in terms of a law practice, most lawyers are woefully unprepared to run a business. So just the mechanics of running a business is challenging enough. Aside from providing the legal services they provide, having to run a business is oftentimes overwhelming in and of itself. And then the idea that on top of that, they need to pay attention to culture and leadership and those kinds of concepts is something that's completely foreign to most attorneys. I think most attorneys would kind of think of culture as a woo-woo or touchy-feely kind of thing that's mostly aspirational. So help me to understand. I mean, in my mind, I think of it sort of like the definition of pornography. I know it when I see it. I know good corporate culture when I see it, but I don't really understand what the components of having a good corporate or good law firm culture might be.
That is such a great question. So really, corporate culture is the DNA of an organization. And if you own an organization, even if it's an organization of one, you have a culture. And the culture starts with your core values. It starts with what matters to you. How do you define yourself? What are the behavioral norms and standards that you expect, as well as those that you won't tolerate? And even if it's just, you know, behavioral norms and standards for yourself, it's important to define them. I was fortunate to have been on Tony Robbins on his podcast to talk about how to create a values-based culture. He had seen an interview with me in Entrepreneur Magazine where I talked about corporate culture, that every organization has a culture. It's either intentional or it's by default. So when we don't pay attention to culture, the way that we end up operating our businesses and the way that we end up showing, even if we're not mindful about it, that becomes our corporate culture. So if we're, you know, running around and we're very reactive, if we are more tactical rather than strategic, if we don't have a long-term growth strategy, if we are willing to accept all of the low-hanging fruit because, you know, getting money in the door is the single most important thing, guess what? That defines your corporate culture versus a company or a business owner that says, this is what I stand for. This is my true north. You know, this is my moral compass on how I'm going to operate every single day. Then that becomes your corporate culture. And even when we are an organization of one, and, you know, I've been there. When I launched Information Experts, I was an organization of one. When I launched Successful Culture, I was an organization of one. Even when we're an organization of just one, we still require other people, right? Nobody can do this alone. So we have relationships with subcontractors, with other vendors, you know, with outsourced organizations that we need, whether it's doing our payroll or IT or, you know, legal, like whatever it is, we need other people. And even if you don't have full-time people, those people become your ecosystem. They become your corporate community. And so you have to have a set of bylaws and standards on how you engage and operate with people. And that does become the baseline for your corporate culture.
Well, I will tell you that my own personal shortcomings in this area, you know, start with the understanding, you know, what is my mission? You know,
yep. Yes.
I struggle with that literally every time I sit down with pen to paper to try and define what my mission is, because my mission is to have a successful business. And I'm not sure that's enough to further drive cultural development. I then have a real challenge translating that mission statement into a set of core values. Mm-hmm. Because to me, a lot of what passes for core values is, you know, self obvious as far as, you know, my viewpoint is, and I know, again, that's a shortcoming on my point. So help me to try and kind of figure that out. Where does the mission of a mm-hmm. firm, its core values, that type of clarity, how does that relate to the overall culture of the firm?
I love that you asked that. So when we work with our clients to help them identify what we call their identity elements, and those are the three of the things that you mentioned are three of the primary identity elements: the values, the mission, and the vision. That's the order in which we help our clients construct those. We have a whole process. We use an online tool called Survey Methods, and we have specific questionnaires and surveys that we distribute to the key stakeholders who will be involved in creating the values, mission, and vision. And for, you know, the solopreneurs, then they obviously are the people who do it, and maybe they might have an advisor that they also want to bring in that will also help them develop their values, mission, and vision. So we help develop the values first, so that companies have clarity around what they stand for. Then after that, we go on to the mission. And the mission is why you exist. Every business wants to make money. Every business wants to turn a profit. Every business wants to be successful. The mission is, why do you exist? So you know, for you, Neil, when you look back and you look at all of the companies and individuals that you have helped over the course of your career lifetime, what has driven you to want to help those companies and what is the, or those people, and what is the impact that you have made through your work? How have you bettered their life by being in it, you know, from a professional perspective? And when you look at those answers, and when we do the mission and vision for our clients, again, we use surveys to extract ideas and information from our clients, we ask those types of questions. So it really all centers around why you exist. That's the mission. And you know, why do you get up every day to do what you want to do? For us, for Successful Culture International, we want to create great places to work where employees feel safe and valued and can thrive. I mean, ultimately, that's why we do the work that we do. For Women CEO Roundtable, we want to create a safe community where our members will feel empowered with the information and the tools and the resources they need to move to their next level and also to live their best life. So those are the mission statements behind those companies. So when we think about mission, it really is all about what gets you up in the morning beyond the fact that you have to bring home a paycheck. Why are you doing exactly what you're doing? And then for the vision, you know, it's where are you going? And some companies out there, look, Coke's vision was to quench thirst. That was Coke's vision statement, to quench thirst. American Cancer Society, their vision was to cure cancer. It doesn't need to be, you know, this 25-word statement. It's getting clarity on where you're going and how you are going to make the world better in the future. That's what the vision statement's all about.
One of the things that I like about that you discussed was your approach to developing those factors is an iterative kind of interactive approach. So often, I think what happens, and I know lots of our listeners have worked with business coaches and you know, personal coaches and what have you, and they give them an assignment: write down your mission statement. And you know, you struggle with what that is.
Yeah.
For a while, or write down what your core values are. What is your vision? And usually it's, where do you want your practice to be in 5 years? Mm-hmm. And to me, those exercises seem so academic and almost disassociated with the reality of what I'm doing, is that to me, they never have any real intrinsic value. And that's probably why I don't do them or live by them, or, you know, why I'm a poor example for that kind of thing. So I like that you espouse kind of an interactive approach and using some tools and methodologies. So it raises my next question. I mean, is culture something that you can build systemically, or is there an approach to improving mm-hmm. it and defining it and measuring it? Is a systemic process that you can follow?
Yes, it's absolutely something that you can build systemically, but I will add the caveat that it's not a one and done approach. It's not like you're going to say, hey, I'm going to engage a company, or I'm going to build my culture for first quarter from September to December, and then I'm going to be done. Culture is a living, breathing element that needs to be addressed literally on a daily basis. And so it's something that business owners need to be mindful of every day. And that's what it is to become a culture-centric organization or a value-centric organization. One thing that we've always educated our clients about is that there are no bad employees. There are simply undesirable behaviors. And so when an employee acts in contradiction to what the company stands for, what the core values are, you know, in a way that challenges, you know, how the company, what the norms are for that company to function, we educate and we coach our clients to redirect the employee back to what the company stands for. And the single most important thing in that is that the leader is acting as an example. Because if a leader is not in alignment with the core values of an organization, they have no right to expect their employees to live those behaviors.
Yeah, the old adage, do as I say, not as I do, is completely inconsistent with that understanding.
It is. And, you know, a very rudimentary fun example of that is, you know, a leader will say, we're having a meeting at 10 a.m. Everybody has to be on time. Well, guess what? If that leader has a track record or a history of being late to their own meetings, and then they're always making excuses on why they're late, how can you possibly expect your employees to value and respect time if you're not doing it yourself? So, you know, leaders are always being watched, and our behavior matters. We are the example for our employees and how we want them to show up. You know, if you're going in and you're trying to standardize communications and you're trying to move your company over to a specific communications tool, you know, or some type of program, and yet you keep defaulting back to using email to communicate because you don't want to be bothered with the tool, what message are you sending? So it really does all start with the leader in terms of how they handle themselves.
You know, I think my own failure in this regard, I don't know why I have to keep talking about my own failures, but they're the ones I'm most familiar with. I think it stems a lot from, you know, my previous lifetime. I was in the management space when the management by objectives performance review process mm-hmm. was becoming in vogue, where you sat down with the employee and you established what the objectives were for the year, and then they were measured against those objectives. And what happened in just vast thousands and numbers of businesses is they went through the process once, created the objective statement, and then never revisited it until the following annual review. And so it really had little value. So your comment that culture is an ongoing, living, breathing thing that needs to be addressed continuously gives credence to, you know, that process, and that it has to be continually part of the aspect of managing a firm or managing a business.
Yeah. And getting back to your question about, is there a systemic process? I don't even know if you're aware that we have this, but we actually have what we call a culture development life cycle. And it is a 5-phase process on how to actually build a sustainable, scalable, lasting culture. And it starts with foundation creation, which is where we define the organization. That's where we build the values, mission, and vision. And mm-hmm. behaviors. We also do a whole program with our client employees. It isn't just about the leaders creating these values and then putting them on what I call coasters and posters and think that you've done that exercise and it's done. You have to educate the employees on the process of building the values, mission, and vision, explain why you've done it, what it means to be a values-centric organization, and what the connection between values, leadership, and culture is, and then create what we call a shared responsibility between the employees and the leaders. Because no matter where you are in an organization, ultimately it's your responsibility to create the experience that you want in that company, and you have a shared responsibility as an employee to live the culture. So we enroll and engage the employees up front during our rollout to educate them and inform them, and then give them a voice on what it means to actually live those values and identify those shared behaviors. So that's our first phase of when we build the identity elements. Mm-hmm. And then we move over to the second phase, which is organizational development, which is shaping the organization. And we have you know, a whole toolbox of different organizational and employee surveys and assessments to get a pulse check on where employees are regarding how they feel about leadership, how they feel about the company, how they feel about the culture. We do those types of anonymous assessments, and that's where we can really identify the gaps between what the leaders often think the company is experiencing and what it really is experiencing. And in our experience, 100% of the time, there's always been a gap. So by examining and identifying that, we're able to, it's like going to the dentist. You know, you go to the dentist for a checkup and you do it as preventive care so that, oh, you see a cavity forming, you don't wait until it's fully formed to get it filled before it, you know, it monsters into something that you can't control. So we're all about being very preventative with organizational issues. And then we work with the leadership as well on communications. So then we move into talent management, and that's where we focus on the recruitment, interviewing, and onboarding models and strategies and processes. And typically when an organization transitions over to be culture-centric and value-centric, their whole entire recruiting process needs to be re-engineered because they need to recruit from the perspective of, are you aligned with our values? Not necessarily just about the experience or the, you know, technical expertise or industry expertise, but are you aligned with our values? Because as I like to say, we can always teach competence, but we cannot teach character. So we need to ensure that there is an alignment between the character and the culture and the values of an organization and not just the competence. And then we move into employee development with coaching. And then we have a whole leadership education academy, a 14-module leadership education academy that many of our clients use to continuously educate their employees and their leadership teams on things like emotional intelligence, self-awareness, communication strategies, conflict resolution, team building, things of that nature that keep people just on top of the skills they need to be as productive as they can.
You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. What I hear the audience asking themselves listening to this is, I hear them saying, well, that's great for a company of 100 or 200 or, you know, can I really apply that concept to my firm where I have, you know, three attorneys, two paralegals, and three staff members, for instance, you know, so a total of about 8 to 10 people. Can I still apply that same kind of thinking or that same kind of process to a smaller firm such as that?
100%. And in fact, I believe that when the companies are small, that's the best time to institute these processes and practices because it's really painful to go back and re-engineer or reverse engineer. So this is why with companies that are just launching or, you know, smaller size companies, this is the time to think about the culture, to be cognizant of it, to really think about what you stand for, where you're going, why you exist, you know, what you to look at your communications models and processes and modalities in terms of how you're communicating both internally and externally, and not taking anything for granted that people actually understand what you're thinking or what you're doing. One, you know, CEOs always can wear several hats and they have such a wide range of talents and skills and abilities. Neil, I have yet to meet a CEO that has one skill. And do you know what that is?
No.
Mind reading.
Yeah, so, I suspect that you're right about that.
Yeah, so this is why communication is so important, that CEOs don't make assumptions about what they think their employees are thinking, that they don't make assumptions about how their employees are perceiving what's happening in the organization. Always asking the question, how am I doing? What is not clear? You know, when I was running Information Experts, one of the things that I did, instead of just holding all hands meetings, I did what we called town hall meetings, and I set up an anonymous survey with our people to get information and feedback on what was I not seeing? What was I missing? You know, mm-hmm. what were the problems, challenges, questions that they had, suggestions that they had? A lot of employees, you know, this typically the way the all hands meeting goes is the CEO stands up in the front of the room, they've got a PowerPoint, they throw it up on the screen, they go through the last quarter, they share some really good news, they give a glimpse into what's happening, and then at the end they go, does anybody have any questions? And then everybody just looks at them for two reasons. Because number one, the CEO is the thing that is standing between them and the lunch that was just catered in. And yep. they don't want to delay the meeting anymore, only because they're hungry or their coworkers are hungry. And so they're not going to delay the meeting with any questions. And number two, they don't want the spotlight on them. So if a leader can create an opportunity for employees to constantly give feedback about what's working or what's not working and what the leader might not be seeing, and then feed that back to the leader, and then the leader can address those things in the town hall, then everybody gets their questions and answers, you know, their questions and challenges addressed, and nobody's on the spot and no one is standing between them and lunch, right? So that's just something that we used to do. I never took it for granted that I knew what my people were thinking.
Well, you know, I think two things that sabotage this whole process frequently are trust and security. If the employee isn't trusting that the words that the firm owner is using are meaningful and internalized by the law firm owners, if they don't trust them and they don't feel like they have the security that they can provide feedback to help guide and mold that culture, it, mm-hmm. it makes it kind of an empty exercise. So what role does trust and security have on the development of corporate culture?
It's the lifeblood of the culture. Without trust, without safety, the culture that you're going to have is a CYA culture. Cover your ass. Like, that's what's going to happen. It's either you're in it for yourself or you're in it for the company. It can't be both. And so creating, it's funny. I literally just did a coaching call with a client and we were talking about this exact thing, that he has an employee that is in a leadership role, and this leader is more focused on managing the processes that are going to ensure that he gets paid a higher commission than it is to manage a customer service team. And what I coached him on was that the message he needs to communicate to that employee, not to take a punitive approach, but to say, look, when you take care of the company will take care of you, right? So, you know, personally, I can see why you want to focus on your commission, but strategically, if we help elevate the entire company to another level, everybody wins. So it's making sure employees know that you have their back. And you're only going to do that by action and by listening to them and by showing up and by putting your ego aside. One of my most important mentors and closest friends, who has built and sold many, many businesses, he's just really one of the most gifted entrepreneurs I know. He taught me a long time ago. He said, the greatest leaders subjugate their own agenda for the greater good of the organization. So when you go to work every day as the leader of the organization, are you thinking about yourself? Are you thinking about your company? And I know when I was running Information Experts, I ascribed to the Robert Greenleaf servant leadership model. There's a full model out there. And what it does is it flips the leadership, it flips the org chart on its head so that the leader of the organization is literally at the bottom of the pyramid. And their whole role is twofold. It's setting the vision and the strategy for the organization, but it's also being in a support role for the employees to say, what do you need to be successful? You need training? We'll get you training. You need resources? We'll get you resources. You need additional personnel support? We'll get you additional personnel support. But the employees need to know that the leader has their back. And when they know that, we're getting into neuroscience now. It's neuroscientifically proven that when employees feel safe in their organization, that they become more emotionally connected, they produce more oxytocin in their brain, and there's a direct impact on the profitability of the organization. And this is why culture is not some woo-woo thing, but it's one of the most strategic imperatives that a company can focus on.
Well, I can certainly see that. That's completely understandable. And I know for a lot of associate attorneys, I get the sense they don't feel that they have that in their firm, that there's lip service paid to the notion of you do well for the firm and the firm will turn around and do well by you, unless there's some consistency there and some actual truth in that statement. Then there's a lack of trust and a feeling of insecurity, and you can't get to those cultural milestones that you want to get to. Mm-hmm. Now, just to kind of wrap this part of the discussion up, because I want to turn to your area regarding community here mm-hmm. in a moment. But just briefly, you and I spoke a while ago about something called the Johari window.
Yeah. Yeah, the Johari window, which framework. Is a model for self-awareness.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to tell you, I'm a real skeptic of these kinds of things, of, you know, the DISCUS personality study and, you know, Myers-Briggs and all that kind of thing. But you're really mm-hmm. passionate about this framework. Tell our audience a little bit about it and why you feel so positive about its usefulness.
Sure. And I've written about it too in my Inc. column, my Inc. magazine column. So I'll send you that link and you can share it with your audience.
Perfect.
So the Johari window is a four-paned window that's all about self-awareness. And the thing is, we can't show up in our best light for others if we don't even know who that person is. So the more self-awareness that we have on how we're showing up, the more we're going to be able to deeply connect. And so there's four panes of the Johari window. There is the open window, and that means that I'm showing you who I am and you're seeing who I am. Like there's transparency mm-hmm. between us. The second window is the hidden window, and that's where I'm hiding a lot from you. And then, you know, but you're also seeing things. But because I'm hiding things from you, you're actually not seeing me in a fully transparent light. The third window is the blind window. And that's where you know things about me, but I don't even know things about me. And that's where our blind spots are. So I may show up in a way and I think that I'm showing up in a certain way, but actually the way I'm coming across is totally different, but no one has told me that. So that's where our blind spots are. They live in the blind window. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth pane is known as the unconscious window. And this is my favorite part of the window because it's so interesting. This is where you don't know things about me and I don't know things about me. And some examples of that are, you know, when we grow up, you know, in our childhood, there are things that happen to us that consciously and unconsciously define us. So these could be things as benign as birth order. You know, if I'm the youngest of three, I have mm-hmm. two brothers who are 6 and 8 years older than I. When I was at the dinner table, I could never get a word in edgewise. Like nobody listened to me. Right? So that type of behavior subconsciously impacts how we feel about ourselves and how we show up. Another example is, I was in fifth grade in elementary school, and I spent a lot of time in the principal's office when I was in elementary school. I mean, I talked nonstop, right? I'm sure that really surprises you. I never shut up.
I actually relate to it quite well.
So I never shut up. Well, when I graduated fifth grade to go to middle school, my principal wrote in my autograph book, he wrote, "Silence the chatter and you will perform miracles." That's how much I talked. Hmm. And if I would have taken that message to heart, maybe I never would have been a communicator. I mean, he got it all wrong, right? So there are things that happen to us, whether it's in childhood, whether it's in relationships, whether it's someone that we love getting ill, whether we get ill, we lose a parent, we're in an abusive relationship, we go to a work environment that's toxic. These are all things that shape who we are and how we show up that we may not even be aware of. And the only way that we become aware of it is through that really difficult work of self-awareness. So that's what happens in the unconscious window. And then when you become aware of it, you can then maybe move to the hidden window where you're like, you know what? I know things about myself, but I'm not comfortable telling the world. Or eventually you'll get to that open window where you're like, you know what? I'm totally comfortable sharing who I am and I'm going to be vulnerable. So that's the framework of really understanding who you are. And ultimately in our relationships, the goal is to get to have an open pain window as much as we're comfortable with, because that's how we're going to deeply connect with others.
And I get the sense in thinking about this is that there are transitional moments where you're back and forth between one mm-hmm. pain or the other, or situational circumstances that dictate influence which pain you are perceived to be located in, and that it's not a static process, that you're labeled with this quadrant of the window pane or window framework, you know, from here on forward.
100%. And we use this work when we do the teamwork and the team building in our client organizations, because the most effective teams are the ones that are the most emotionally connected and that feel the safest and have the greatest amount of transparency. So in order to feel safe on a team in an organization, we do this work to be able to help them move towards that open window. And again, this gets back to corporate culture, which is why our Leadership Education Academy, why we have a module in there. Because leaders need to understand the vital importance of creating safe environments where employees can feel vulnerable. And again, it starts with the leader. The leader needs to feel vulnerable, to be able to say, I don't have all the answers, or I've made a mistake, or I'm concerned about this. And they need to be vulnerable to allow their employees to be vulnerable.
Well, then let's transition, because I think that's a perfect segue into understanding the role of community in terms of developing your business, developing your law firm, and how one might go about gaining the expertise of others in things mm-hmm. like an advisory board or a mastermind group or something along those lines. So talk about the power of community a little bit and what your views are.
Sure. So this is something that's near and dear to my heart. I'm very passionate about it. My experience is, as you know, I wrote the number one best-selling book, Built to Scale, How Companies Create Breakthrough Advisory Boards for Exceptional Growth. That's a whole model on how to create advisory boards so that you have the right people around the table for your business, guiding you to move you through what I call the holes and goals of your organization. So where are the areas where you have deficits, and then where are the areas in which you have, dreams and goals that you want to achieve? So how do you strategically hand select the experts and advisors that can be on your advisory board? So that's one type of community. Another type of community are these shared boards or these shared advisory groups. And those are the Vistages of the World, Entrepreneurs Organization with their forums. I was the regional chair for Women's Presidents Organization, and I led 20, you know, women CEOs in their peer group. And then that was our motivation for launching Women's CEO Roundtable, to create a peer community where women business owners could feel supported and connected. So you've got your shared board. Another example of that is the mastermind. I'm a certified mastermind facilitator, and I've been in a mastermind group for about 10 years now that truly is transformative. We meet every quarter for once a quarter for 8 hours, and they're all solopreneurs in that group. And the reason it's so important for solopreneurs to get out there and intentionally create these peer advisory groups is because it can be really lonely, and it's really important to get out of our own head. And you know, Neil, I was fortunate to meet you through Cadre, you know, Derek. Yep. And Melanie Coburn's organization, Cadre. And one of the greatest values that they provide through Cadre is to have their mastermind hot seats, you know, that they have created these mastermind groups that get together once a quarter and bring members together. And they put so much, you know, thought and time into who should be in that room together so that we can help each other. It's really, really important, especially for solopreneurs, not to just get cocooned in their own world and think that, oh, well, I need an answer to something, I'll just Google it, but to really connect with other leaders who have been where they are, who are experiencing what they're going through. The whole idea of masterminding, you know, goes back, oh my God, I think like a century. And, you know, the most, you know, Andrew Carnegie had a mastermind with incredible people. And the whole idea behind masterminding, as Napoleon Hill defined it, it's literally the creation of a separate mind when you bring multiple minds together. So it's really essential for growth.
You know, I can see how, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to be a part of something like Cadre here, but not everybody is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think if you were to say to the average solo or small firm practitioner that you might benefit from the creation of a advisory board who mm-hmm. could give you some guidance as to how you might manage or grow your law firm, I think the first thing they would say is, well, who's going to want to do that for me? I mean, how would I go about even broaching the subject with people that, you know, I have some relationship with or have might have some value to my organization, but what's in it for them? And it doesn't seem like something that a law firm owner intuitively would understand.
Okay. So, you know, I'm really big on like double checking the stories that we tell ourselves. Yeah. And when a business owner says to themselves, well, why would anyone help me? That's a self-limiting belief and a story that they're telling themselves, because there are millions of people out there that can help you. And I've always believed it's never a lack of resources, but a lack of resourcefulness that holds us back. And people want to help each other. Overall, society is a generous society, and especially in the entrepreneurial universe, we love helping each other. So whether it's belonging to certain Facebook groups where we can get advice, you know, or belonging to a LinkedIn community or a LinkedIn page where we can get advice, the first step is to adapt the mindset that there are people out there that want to help me and I'm comfortable asking for help. And then I would recommend them, honestly, to buy my book. I mean, I go through the whole model on how to figure out what you need first and then how to go out and actually find the people that can help you. And again, whether you're one employee, you know, one organization of one or 10 or 100, surrounding yourself with the people that can get you to the next level is an essential piece of your success.
Well, I think we need to put that on a t-shirt. It's not a lack of resources, but rather a lack of resourcefulness.
Yeah.
I think that would sell awfully well. Well, Marissa, I could probably spend another hour chatting with you here.
It would be fun.
So we'll have to schedule that down the road. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything that you said today.
So they can get to Successful Culture at successfulculture.com. They can get to the book at built to scale, all spelled out, .info. And I'm on LinkedIn. I'm big on LinkedIn. So find Marissa Levin. I'm big on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I don't use Instagram, but somehow I have 20,000 followers. I'm not really sure who's following me. I only use it to stalk my kids. But certainly connect with me on all the different social media platforms and sign up for our weekly blog. And also the Culture Podcast is now out on all of the major platforms where we are sharing best practices and stories of how to create great places to work for companies from 1 to 1,000. So definitely subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you are at the Culture Podcast.
And there's no lack of opportunity to follow up on this discussion.
Nope.
Great. All right, Marissa, thanks ever so much for being a part of The Law Entrepreneur.
You're welcome, and thank you for the work you do, Neil.
Well, that will do it, fellow law entrepreneurs, for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors this week. That would be Ruby Receptionists, Jurisdiction. Be sure to visit us on our website at www.thelawentrepreneur.com or check us out on our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. Just search for The Law Entrepreneur. You'll find us. Make sure you consider joining our private Facebook group where we'll be having some new offerings starting the first of the year. So I want you to have a great week, and we'll see you next time. And thank you for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.